Episode 394 of CBP Cast with guest Anders Knutten, recorded 8th of November 2024. In this episode, we talk about the latest CISA report on software safety, C++ safe buffers and Clang 20, and about C++ Swift interop. Then we are joined by Anders Knutten. Anders talks to us about cppquiz.org and about his new book, C++ Brain Teasers. Welcome to episode 394 of CPPcast, the first podcast for C++ developers by C++ developers. I'm your host, Timo Dumler, joined by my co-host, Phil Nash. Phil, how are you doing today?
I'm all right, Timo. How are you doing?
I'm all right. There's a lot going on. Next week, I am going to Bristol, UK for the Audio Developer Conference, then to Berlin for meeting C++, and then to Poland for the committee meeting. So busy preparing for all that right now. Also, we got snow here in Finland now, so winter has officially started. What about you, Phil? What's new on your side?
I'm not sure, can't remember if I mentioned it last time, but I've sort of started a new role, part-time developer advocate at Undo. Maybe familiar to many people who listen to the show.
Oh, those are the people with the time travel debugger, right?
That's right, yeah. So we'll probably have somebody from Undo on again soon. We've been talking about that for a while. Actually got some really interesting stuff going on at the moment, and seeing it from the other side sort of makes me excited to want to start talking about it. But we'll put that off for now. Let somebody else do that talking.
So you're going to be doing that in parallel with your conference organizing stuff and your workshops.
Exactly. And that's why it's part-time. So I'm just doing a few days a month while I continue to be independent the rest of the time.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to the things you come up with in that new role.
Yes. Yeah, me too.
All right. So we'd like to hear your thoughts about the show. You can always reach out to us on X, Mastodon, LinkedIn, or email us at feedback@cbbcast.com. Joining us today is Anders Knutten. Anders started programming in Turbo Pascal in 1995 and has been programming professionally in various languages since 2001. He is the author of the book C++ Brain Teasers and the websites cppquiz.org and blog.knutten.org. Anders has worked with everything from websites to CPU design, but his main focus these days is C++, which he also likes to speak about at conferences around the world. When not geeking out with computers, Anders likes to go to industrial music festivals and produce his own music as Modulo One. Anders, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So Modulo One, obviously a bit of a programming pun there, but that's a band, is it? Or
it's kind of a two-person band,
right?
Doing all sorts of like industrial-related music.
Interesting. Although presumably, although two person, when you apply Modulo One, there's only one left.
that's left as an exercise to the audience.
So is it more like purely electronic industrial, or is it more like industrial metal, or like
what is it? Electronic one. So EBM, future pop, dark electro, industrial techno kind of stuff.
Cool. Well, that sounds great. I'd like to listen to that stuff. Yeah,
it's basically just me trying to make whatever I like listening to. So.
That's good.
All right. So, Anders, we'll get back to you in a few minutes, but first we have a couple of news articles to talk about. So feel free to comment on any of these, okay? So the first news item today is a new report by the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, also known as CISA, about software security. It actually came out, I think, 3 or 4 weeks ago, but what made me aware of it was another article on the internet on the news stack, which linked to that, and then I looked at the original report. So it is the strongest stance yet from the U.S. government to call to abandon C and C++ or move from C and C++ to memory-safe languages like Rust. Their calls are getting louder and stronger as time goes by. And so now they're basically saying that, you know, anyone who is like still writing in memory-unsafe languages or writing memory-unsafe code basically, you know, is negligent. I think I can interpret it as that. I can quote from the original report. It says the development of new product lines for use and service of critical infrastructure in a memory safe language, in a memory unsafe language, such as C or C++, where there are readily available alternative memory safe languages that could be used, is dangerous and significantly elevates risk to national security, national economic security, and national public health and safety. For existing products that are written in memory unsafe languages, not having a published memory safety roadmap by January 1st, 2026, which is just over a year from now, is dangerous and significantly elevates risk to national security, et cetera, et cetera. So the clock is ticking. They're saying basically either move away from C and C++ within a year or make your C and C++ somehow magically memory safe within a year or risk being labeled as negligent. That is a pretty strong stance there. So what do you think about that?
I don't know if I'm looking at your notes here. I don't know if this is paraphrased or copied verbatim, but it says move away from C slash C++. That would be quite easy because that doesn't exist. So maybe that's the way out.
So the quote in the notes is from the original report. So it says, for example, C or C++.
Okay.
So it's talking about memory unsafe languages in general.
Right. Yeah.
The way I read the intro here, at least on the webpage, is more, if you're doing greenfield stuff, then maybe don't do C++, which fine, I guess. And if you are doing C++, have a roadmap. And I can, like, the roadmap doesn't have to be like take all of Sean Baxter's work now. It could be like set up sanitizers and fuzzers or whatever.
Yeah, it's all a bit vague. Like, I think the other article that we're going to put a link to that in the notes as well says, like, maybe interprets it quite strictly. They say, like, you're basically negligent if you're not doing this and you're going to get sued or whatever. And maybe that's not the only possible interpretation. Maybe that's not what the report actually says. I have to admit, I didn't read the whole thing. I kind of just skimmed it.
I only read the intro as well. So
Yeah. Well, they don't seem to be like introducing any hard regulation yet, but I don't know. Maybe they do, and I didn't see it in the report. But
yeah, but each one seems to be getting stronger and stronger. So maybe it's a rather trajectory. Although, don't want to talk too much about this, but mostly for the benefit of people sort of coming back and listening to this in the future. As we record this week, there has been a change in the government in the US. So we're not going to talk about that. But I do wonder whether that may have some impact down the line. Maybe they'll take their eye off this. I don't know. Probably not. But
so the actual report came out in October 16th. So that was like three and a half weeks ago. So that was before the US election that happened this week.
Yeah, it would take a while for that to have any impact, if any, but you never know.
Right. So we're not going to talk about politics on the show.
No, definitely not.
I'm sure we all have our thoughts on that, but let's leave them for later. Continuing on the topic of software safety, Clang 20 comes with a new feature, C++ Safe Buffers. Mm. So yeah, that is meant to harden your code, harden your C++ code against buffer overflows, which is one of the main sources of security vulnerabilities in C++ today. It's kind of a multi-pronged approach. It says, well, there's a bunch of prerequisites, so you have to use a libc++ that was compiled with a hardening on. So there's a bunch of hardening modes, so you need to use at least the fast mode, which enables the kind of buffer overflow hardening for like containers and like vectors and span and stuff. And you also need to a compiler library built with this flag, libcpp ABI bounded iterators, which I think kind of hardens iterators somehow. Haven't looked in detail into how that works, but yeah, it's another built mode or flag or something you can do now. And then when you do that, you can enable this new warning, -W unsafe buffer usage. And that's going to fire whenever you perform any unsafe buffer operations on a row pointer, which includes any kind of array indexing with square bracket, like indexing into any kind of like row array that you got from a pointer, any form of pointer arithmetic, any bounds unsafe C functions like memcopy, etc., any unsafe smart pointer operations like indexing into a unique pointer, or I guess get the row pointer out or something like that, because they can't be made safe because of how the language works. So on all of those, you can you now get a compiler warning, which you can turn into an error if you want to be really hardcore about this. And in order to avoid that, what you need to do is you need to encapsulate any row buffer usage, anything where you access data through a rule pointer that is a like an array underneath, you have to encapsulate that into like a safe container or a safe view, such as, you know, vector or span with the hardened mode on. Otherwise, the compiler is going to bark at you. So that's the new feature. Mm-hmm. That sounds interesting. That's probably going to be a lot of code that's not going to compile when you turn that on.
Yeah, but another useful tool. And I think this is a good demonstration of this sort of many-pronged attack on the whole safety issue. As we mentioned last time, you know, there's the two primary approaches. Do we fix up the language, or do we introduce things that are going to make existing usage of the language safer? And that's not just the committee's responsibility, but tools can also give us useful tools like this to help. And it's one of a steady stream of such tools that are coming out. So it's worth keeping on top of what your compiler can do to help you.
So I'm actually thinking this is kind of a bit similar, like what Rust does, but like safe and unsafe blocks, but obviously just for buffer overflow and not for any of the other kinds of UB. But I guess if you have a class that uses a raw buffer underneath, like you have your own container or your own smart pointer or whatever, some people do things like that. I guess you can just stare at that code long enough to convince yourself that it's fine, and then basically disable the error just on that one. But then use that everywhere. I think you're supposed to really use the standard library containers and views in the hardened mode and not roll your own. I guess that's kind of a part of the point that they're trying to make here.
Yeah, and no matter what approach we take, there's always going to be a point where we have to distrust something. Mm-hmm. It's like this part, we're just going to say this is fine, and this becomes the axiom that we can build everything else on.
Right. So while you know, the US government keeps warning us about using C and C++, and C and C++ tool vendors are coming up with new tools to make it safer, there's also other languages around C++ or that want to make it safer or replace it with something safer, or just, you know, interop with it or provide a safe alternative. There's a lot of that also going on. I just want to mention two things. CPP Front, which is Herb's pet project, which is kind of this new kind of wrapper around C++, kind of new successor language / a kind of like new syntax on top of C++ that compiles to C++ or transpiles to C++. So that's now out in a version 0.8. So it's still very much pre-version 0, use at your own risk, but it now is available with a new license, which is Apache 2.0 with LLVM exception, which for the first time allows commercial use. So Herb is saying that's now stable enough for that. You're still at your own risk, but like it's kind of now, you know, you could contemplate actually using it in some kind of real project.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. There's also a bunch of new features like regularized function syntax. He has decal type now. He has this hashable meta function. There's lots of other stuff. I'm not going to list all of that. You can read it yourself. But yeah, development on that is ongoing.
Yeah, and I think that's the interesting point, that this is being actively developed still.
Yeah, and there's a bunch of contributors as well. So it's not just Herb. There's a bunch of people actively submitting pull requests and driving this forward. I think it's still very much like a hobby effort at this point still. I don't think there's anybody backing it with money at this point. At least I'm not aware of it. But let's see. Let's see how it goes. It's certainly an interesting project. And then our final news item is something that you just dug out, Phil, isn't it? So do you want to talk about that one?
Yeah, so actually, just to be transparent on this, I only saw this sort of 10 minutes before we started recording. So I haven't read it in depth, but I thought it sort of fit in with what we've just been talking about so well. We couldn't really not mention it. And this is the Swift C++ interoperability, which we mentioned before, particularly when Doug Greger was on. That's something that is still an ongoing effort. And they have added some new features to that. And there's an article on the Swift forums, which we'll put a link to, Safe and Efficient C++ Interoperability via Non-Escapable Types and Lifetimes. So this fits right into what we've been talking about with you know, lifetime management, but from the perspective of interoperability with Swift. And just a couple of choice quotes from the article, so I haven't read it in depth, but I think this gives you a flavor But right at the start, it says safely interacting with unsafe code is challenging. I don't think anybody's going to disagree with that.
It's an understatement, I would say.
but a bit later, goes on to say, we propose using annotations to express lifetime information for C++ APIs. Mm-hmm. And one of those is a Clang attribute, Clang lifetime bound. There may be some others, as I say, I haven't read it fully, but these are things that you can use today. And it talks about how you can use these annotations to mark up your code so that you can use it safely from Swift. And the interesting bit is this non-escapable stuff. And so I haven't read the article in depth, but I know from my own knowledge of Swift that a non-escapable type is one where if you have a lambda or closure in Swift, but we know in C++ we have the problem of that the lifetime of the lambda can outlive the data that it has references to, and you can get these dangling references you have to be very careful of. Well, in Swift, they solved that problem by having this escaping attribute to say this closure escapes the scope that it was created in. So there may be lifetime issues, and then the language can actually work on that for you and introduces some overhead with copying, but it only does that work when it needs to because you put this annotation in. Obviously, we don't have that in C++, so that's where these annotations are coming in to sort of give you back that ability to say when the lifetime of a lambda or a closure actually escapes the scope that it was created in. You may need to address these lifetime issues. So I thought that was quite interesting and definitely a nod towards using Swift as potentially a safer successor language for C++ and interoperating with it.
That's interesting. But yeah, it strikes me that all of these attempts at somehow introducing memory safety like kind of fall into three camps, right? So there's only like a limited amount of approaches possible, it seems. So the first one seems to be just track all the like memory at runtime, like address sanitizer, or you can do it in hardware now with something like Sherry, right? Like tag pointers. Yeah. And so either do that or change the object model to like track that stuff statically at compile time to not allow you to have, you know, things that escape a certain scope or mutable shared state or anything like that. Like basically the Rust borrow checker or something very similar to that, right? That's like the second approach. And the third approach seems to be these lifetime annotations where you kind of take code and just annotate it with, you know, this outlives that, or, you know, this must be like non-zero here or whatever, and then again let the compiler figure it out.
Yeah,
I think everything I see is like kind of a repetition of one of these three approaches, which is interesting. So this seems to be like the annotation approach.
Yes.
Well, let's see which one wins.
Right.
Okay. So I think we talked enough about safety. Let's
talk about unsafety.
Let's move on to our main guest for today, Anders. Hello again. Thank you very much for being on the show with us today.
Yeah, hello, and thanks for inviting me.
So last time you were on the show, this is not the first time you're here. Last time you were on the show, it was back in 2018 when Rob and Jason were still running it. And you talked about your cppquiz.org suite of CPP quizzes. So we can talk about that again today, but also you have a new book out, right? It's called C++ Brain Teasers.
Yeah.
Is that somehow related to cppquiz.org, and how did that happen? Can you give us a bit of context here?
Yeah, so I wasn't really planning on writing that book, but the pragmatic programmers, they have like this series on like C brain teasers and Rust and Python and all these brain teasers. And they were looking for someone to do C++ book in that series. Right. And then it was Francis Buontempo, who had just published a book, I think, with PragProg.
Yes.
And she just introduced me to the publisher, and then we decided to write a book. So that's how it came about, and it is related to CPP quiz. I don't think it would have happened if I didn't.
Yeah,
that site, but yeah, it's not just a printed formal website. It's different to that, but it's kind of based the thing I'm doing there.
So all of the brain teasers in there, are they new, or are some of them based on what you have on CPP quiz?
A few of them are based on the website, but most of them are new, and all the explanations are new and much longer. Because it's like a 120 pages or so long book with only 25 questions in it. So it's not like not just a quiz book. It was like the main thing is that you have this question to get people to wonder about a certain thing, right. And then you have some pages of explaining like how exactly does this language work here? Why is it trying to trick people into learning something?
Yeah. Are you able off the top of your head to sort of sketch out an example? I know that's hard on an audio podcast, but is there anything you can like give a flavor of sort of questions you might have in there?
Yeah, I have the book in front of me, like this one that's easy to explain without actually showing the code. Uh-huh. So it's one of the easier ones, like the second one. So we have we have two overloads of a function called serialize. One takes a void pointer and one takes a string ref, the string ref, and then you call it with a string literal.
Right.
And then, is that string ref? You mean string view or?
No, a reference to a...
Oh, ref, like just a language ref, reference.
Yeah, check. Reference yeah. to a yeah, yeah. string, and the other yeah, one yeah. is a void pointer. And when you call yes. it with a string literal, it prefers yeah. the void pointer overload instead of the string one.
Yeah.
Yes.
And yes. So this is... A lot of people who have been writing C++ for a while understand that that's the case, but then you have a few pages talking about, okay, how actually does overload resolution work? And like, what about, why do we have all this, or not why, but at least explaining all these weak piping kind of things, with all it's very eager to do all implicit conversions and stuff like that. And so it's an excuse to talk about those things.
Mm-hmm.
And then, in some places it's like an undefined or an initialized variable on the stack. And it like reuses the one from the last time you called that function. And then it explains like, my particular system, this is how the stack works, and this is why you see that behavior. But actually, C++ doesn't require that. And like, yeah, so it's all sorts of like excuses to talk about, try to like understand more about how the language works. So it's very little about how does this library work or stuff like that. It's more about understanding the fundamental things, which is just what I happen to find interesting.
Yeah, it sounds like these are not just like dark corners of the language. Like, nobody would ever know this anyway, but it's fun. We have that sometimes. I know because I've done some of your quizzes, but this sounds much more practical. This is like stuff we probably should know, but they're sort of on the cusp of the border of what people actually know in practice.
Yeah.
I'm trying to keep it very practical. So these have been selected to be like, you should learn something that's actually useful to know. And I try to always have like, so this is a bad thing, and you would avoid it by this particular warning or this sanitizer, or like here are some tools you can use to avoid these things. And
right.
trying to, because tpquiz.org is full of like weird stuff, because I have opened up for submissions. And when do you submit a question to a tpquiz site? It's when you just discover something super weird.
Ah.
This is so strange. I have to submit it to tpquiz. So there's too many weird questions, I think, on the website. So. I've tried hard to not make the big deal.
So you just mentioned that people can submit suggestions to tpquiz. How does that work? How can we get involved? Like, how does that work?
So there's, if you just go to the site, there's on the right hand margin, there's a submit your own question kind of thing.
Right.
It's something I did because I wanted to save time, didn't write these questions myself. But then people start submitting all this weird stuff that I don't know. And it's not just a question and answer thing. It's like there's always an explanation with the reference to the standard saying like, okay, here are the relevant sections explaining exactly why this is the case, why the answer is correct. So then I end up with all that work trying to understand these things that I've never heard about because someone submitted it. So I'm not really saving time, but I'm at least poked into getting new content.
Right.
So how did you get the idea to start this in the first place?
It was at the ACU conference in 2012 or 13 or something. Then Oliver Maudal was having one of his pub quizzes. Mm-hmm. And yeah, then I was in the bar and I got a bit drunk and I figured someone has to make a website for this kind of thing. And then I went to my room and started like drunk coding some stuff in Python and Django, which I kind of almost knew a little bit. And yeah, basically finished the first version then. Some nights at ACU and on the train and the plane back home. So if you look at the source code for the website itself on GitHub, you will see that it's very well implemented. It's been working now for 11 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just asked for some ideas, and then lots of people just sent me their stuff from their pub quizzes from other conferences. So that's how the site got started, and then I kept adding stuff. Trying now to publish easier and more relevant things so that you can not only see this weird corner people dug up.
Yeah. Right. So has your relationship with it changed over time? Then you have like a different goal in mind, maybe?
For the website?
Yeah.
Yeah, so first I published a lot of stuff, and then I just stopped doing C++ for a few years, and I kind of had it on the back burner for almost 5 years. I was doing something else. So I want to keep it alive, and then I got back to C++ again, and then I've been trying to keep it a bit more alive now, and yeah, trying to get it to be more, to have more relevant content. And you have like three difficulties on the question. You have like beginner, intermediate, and expert. And beginner is like not totally beginner, but no C++ a bit. And so I want to make some way to like filter out all the expert questions or something to make it a bit more beginner friendly.
Yeah.
And
thanks for that.
Just the main work with that is just adding enough content to so that there's still lots to do.
Yeah.
Only the beginner friendly question.
Wait. All right. I mean, you've been running it for so many years now. You've seen many different C++ versions come and go. So you're constantly adding things from new language versions in there.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's basically whatever comes to mind if I see something interesting, or mostly nowadays people submitting stuff. But like all the questions say, according to C++ 23, what's the output of this question? Like, and you either you say it's kind of compile and you type in the answer, or you say it's undefined behavior, like you select from the drop down.
Hmm.
And yeah, so the reason we just ported it to C++ 23 is that I for each question you get an explanation with reference to the standard, and I want it to be correct for the whatever standard we have now. And so what I could do is just like whenever I get a new question, I say it's according to C++ 23, and then the old ones are still at 11. But then you know, every time you go to a new question, it's like shows you a new version of the standard. So I don't want that either. So
yeah.
What we did, I just exported the entire database to a GitHub repo and then got the community to help me port it over the summer. Basically just updating everything. And there were a couple of questions that actually changed the answer. Most of it is just like stuff moved around in the standard, or there's a different way to reason about these things. A few things actually did change.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. What do you have an example at the top of your head of something that actually changed?
You have prepared
the answer?
Something.
I think
we have something about the range four with R value kind of thing.
Right.
I think there's a question about that.
Yes.
Yeah, there was a thing that if you have a range based for loop, and you iterating over like something which is a temporary that returns a temporary, then that temporary goes out of scope when the when that expression is evaluated. So you're iterating over something that doesn't exist anymore, and you're in UB land. And you fix that in CSS 23. But that actually changes behavior. For example, there are cases where that thing that you're iterating over, like if you create it, it takes a lock, for example, and then if it, you destroy it, it like releases the lock. It actually changes behavior. So there are like interesting cases like that.
Yeah, I think we had a question about that. There's something in the book about this as well. About lifetimes. There are several questions about lifetimes in the book.
doesn't surprise me.
So now any temporary lives until you actually looped over that. So that's I think over the years there were quite a few topics where like the standard changed, like what it says or what it does, like things like aggregate types. I think the initialization for aggregates has changed, I think, in every standard. And there's other areas like that. Or like when a type is an aggregate and when it's not an aggregate and things like that.
Yeah, I think like now you can actually inherit, you don't have any virtual functions or anything, you can inherit from something and still be an aggregate. Before.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff like that. It's interesting that you chose C++ 23 because it only became the official standard like literally a few weeks ago, and I think most people don't actually kind of use it in their day-to-day coding. So what motivated you to go to the latest standard so early?
Avoiding work.
Right.
Because it was on 17 and it's a lot of work to port everything. Like one question can take like 1 minute to just verify it's the same, or it can take an evening to figure out all the new stuff. So it's a lot of work to port it, and I never got around to port it to 20. And then people kept asking, can we please port it? People got 17 is old now. And then I figured, okay, let's go straight to 23. Because I for several person weeks of effort to port all of it. So, and I don't really have a lot of time to spend on this. So in order to not do that twice, we just went straight to 23. But someone brought up the argument that we should do 20 because no one uses 23, but that the answers to all but one or two questions would be the same. It's just like the explanation is a bit different in 23 than it was. And I don't have to 3 years from now spend like another several weeks for everything.
Do you also incorporate new features, or is it just a matter of porting like your existing database of questions?
Yeah, when I port, I just port all the questions out there. I just dump everything to a GitHub repo and people help out. Shout out to there's a user on GitHub. Their username is Tokik. They did a lot of the work. So yeah, thanks for that. But yeah, then we just port everything and we just dump everything back into the database. And then, but then that enables me to now be able to start adding stuff.
Yeah.
Sometimes I get submissions or ideas for new things, but I can't do it yet because the site is still on 17. Or...
So there's no C++ 23 specific questions in just yet, but
I don't think you added anything. Yeah. Okay. Now we can.
Yeah.
I was just trying to think of something. I think there are a few nasty things with deducing this where like
I was thinking that
not nasty, it's a great feature, but like it's a little bit odd if you haven't used it yet. So I think that's one where you could probably come up with interesting questions.
Yeah.
Is it more like language stuff that you do there or more like library stuff?
Mostly language stuff, at least the things I do, because that's what I happen to find interesting. And it's kind of timeless knowledge to just like have a better gut feeling of how the language actually works when you try to learn something new or there's a bug or something. And well, actually, I know how this works like one layer below the layer I'm trying to understand, and it's a lot easier to figure it out. But yeah, there's some library stuff as well.
Right. Yeah, I don't think we have that many new language features in C++ 23, actually. I think deducing this is like the main one I can think of.
Multidimensional subscript operator.
Right, yeah. Right. But that's not kind of one where there's a bear trap that you could...
Yeah, could be.
Or maybe there is, and I just don't know about it, yeah.
Well, given that it's come from C++ 17 previously, so you could have overloaded the comma operator, and now that won't work as of 20, and then in 23 it has a new meaning, so could be something there.
But also, you haven't covered, you didn't cover C++ 20 before, so you could add stuff about like modules and concepts and coroutines and what was the fourth one?
Or the spaceship operator.
The spaceship
that actually changes the meaning of some existing code, doesn't it? So.
Oh, the spaceship operator. Yes, yes. I have to say, I haven't actually used or seen it in the wild, the spaceship operator. I kind of...
You haven't seen a spaceship in the wild?
I've used it just as a simple struct that's just wrapped some other type, and then it's just like spaceship default.
Yeah, I use it in some of my testing material. It's quite useful to be able to just quickly add all the conditional operators to a type.
Right. Have you run into any unexpected stuff with that yet, or does it just do what it says on the tin?
I suppose sometimes it doesn't work the way I expected it to, mostly because I haven't internalized the syntax.
Hmm.
But no, nothing that breaks anything.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you had some time away from C++.
Yeah.
Was that before the last time you were on the show? Because I think you said in 2018 you'd just come back.
Yeah, that's right. That's when I just came back after 5 years doing something else.
Right. So what brought you back? You couldn't get enough of C++.
The reason I went back to C++ was because I quit the other job I had after 5 years.
Right.
Really going anywhere. And then I had done some C++ in the past, and there's a lot of cool stuff that happens with C++. So like
never a dull day.
Yeah, but like there's so many cool things people make with it. So that's I don't particularly think C++ is a great language. It's like it's fine. It gets the job done, but there are, I think
for it's some fun. Definition of fine.
Well, there's the languages people complain about and the languages nobody uses.
Right.
Yeah. And like I don't have all the issues that people complain about with C++ all the time. I don't think they come up day to day that much, that they really annoy me that much. So I think it's fine, but people do so many cool things. So when I quit my job and wanted to go back to doing C++. I interviewed with a lot of companies in Oslo. Like people, I ended up in Civid doing 3D cameras, which is lots of really cool stuff to do.
Hmm.
And then we have Cisco in Oslo doing all their video conferencing stuff. And Qt is in Oslo, Remarkable, that they weren't. But like there are so many cool things, and InkludeOS, they didn't have budget to hire anyone, but that was the coolest interview I've ever been to.
Wow.
So if you're not familiar with InkludeOS, it was a project where you just like basically say hash include OS at the top of your file, you compile it, and it becomes an operating system.
Yeah.
That runs.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Code.
Wait, what?
It's like it's a micro kernel or whatever they call the thing. You just compile your program into like an image that you can run, and it only has the part of the OS that you actually use.
You can run on what?
On a on a virtual machine hypervisor or like whatever.
Yeah.
You can have like you make like a network switching thing in C++, and you just compile it down to an OS that can run on a VM, and the entire OS is then like 14 kilobytes or something, including your application. And it has zero attack surface. There is no bash. There is no nothing, right? So you can't really hack it either. So it's pretty cool. And it can boot in like 10 milliseconds.
Whoa. Okay. Wait. Okay. I guess I need to look into that. Like, how does that work? Like, don't you need like a kind of a kernel that does stuff? Is that just all completely modular? Is that like based on Linux? Is that like written from scratch? What is that?
I think most of it was written from scratch. So they had like a bootloader and TCP IP stack and maybe some web server stuff and kernel and everything. And then you just compile your program and you link it, and everything you don't use just doesn't get included. So there's nothing more to the OS than exactly what you use in your program. So it's pretty cool. They went under due to lack of funding.
Oh no.
At some point. But that was a really cool project.
Yeah, episode 63 back in 2016 was all about InkludeOS. So
all right.
Go listen to that one if you want to know more.
All right. Yeah, that's cool.
What I was saying was that like why C++? It's just because people do so many cool things with it. That's basically it. And why I keep doing C++.
Yeah. No, I think this is one of the things that keeps me motivated as well. Just this week we had so I live in Helsinki. We have a monthly meetup here that I'm running, and like every month we are somewhere else, right? And depending on who can host us. And this week we were at Remedy, which is one of the big video game studios here. And obviously they do everything in C++, and just being there and then like seeing how they develop like really cool video games. And I'm like, yeah, okay. I mean, yes. You know, working with C++ sometimes is painful, but that's what comes out. Like, how cool is that? You know,
yeah.
You can't really do that on that scale in like in another programming language. That's pretty cool.
Remedy, that's the old demo scene people, or it used to be at least.
I mean, the games that they did were Max Payne, Alan Wake.
Yeah,
there are some people from the 90s. Yeah, I think yeah.
Yeah, I've actually been approached by someone. I can't talk too much about it because it's all proprietary, but they want me to do some training for people who have been doing C# and they want to learn C++, and they're going to port all that code base over. So some of that's going in the other direction. It's quite interesting.
So porting something from C# to C++.
Yes.
Why would you want to do that?
I presume the performance.
Right.
It matters in the particular industry that they're in. That's usually the reason.
Right. That reminds me, Andash, you actually mentioned when we were preparing this episode, you mentioned that you actually also recently ported something from Rust, I believe, to C++. Like, what was that about? Why would anybody do that?
To get a clickbaity title for a podcast. The idea was that we had a new thing that we were using internally, and someone prototyped it in Rust because they like Rust, and I think it's also because that's the language where they knew how to make a user interface know a library. And then that was proving that we should try to do this thing. And then we wanted to make it more integrated into all the other stuff we do. And we integrate a lot with LLVM, and that's a C++ like API. So we just figured it's easier to do our thing in C++ as well, because it's a startup kind of thing. So we have to like do things quickly, and then like, okay, so let's just use this LLVM types currently in our entire system instead of wrapping everything and like making a nice API boundary. Like, we don't have stuff to do, time to do that kind of stuff. We just need to get something working quickly, and then just embrace the LLVM and then use the C++. So that was the reason. So, but that's worked worked out fine. But I think it was also nice to that this other I did it in Rust first, because that's what he wanted to do, and just prove his point, and then like, okay, let's do this.
Yeah, I mean, this reminds me of kind of something that somebody said to whom we had on the show. I'm not going to mention any names, but like a conversation I had recently about how this whole thing about safety maybe is a little bit kind of misunderstanding what C++ is about. It is really all about the performance, right? Because it lets you do things that like you could maybe do with C and assembler, but that doesn't scale in the same way, because it doesn't let you, it doesn't have these abstraction mechanisms that C++ has.
Yeah.
And that's really what the language is about. And like, there is an opinion, which is not the majority opinion right now, I guess, if you read the news at the moment, or like, if you look at the news items that we had lately, but it is an opinion that some people hold that I kind of can sympathize with, is that, you know, trying to make C++ memory safe, or like adding all of this, all of these checks and making it more like Rust with like the borrow checker or whatever, that's not what C++ is about. You know, if you want to do that, just go into Rust. You know, C++ is about performance. So I think I can get behind that. I don't know if the US government can, though. So
yeah, it's also like not only about performance, but what you use it for. So this thing that we're doing here is like, we have to memory map a lot of stuff into these exact places in memory. And there's a JIT, so we JIT our own assembly language over to x86, then we execute some stuff in a JIT, and that can do whatever it wants, like, and that the simulated process has access to the simulator, so we can like modify each other's memory. And like, I don't care if someone writes outside of a vector boundary or something. That's not one that's what's gonna cause me bugs. Like, there are way worse things going on that's gonna cause the bugs. Yeah, so I don't really need memory safety that much for this particular project.
So I think it's very similar to the kind of things that I, you know, was working on in the past, or have seen how things are made. Like, if you're writing, you know, a piece of music software or a video game or even an IDE, I guess, like, the bits that are actually safety and security relevant, where you like log in and talk to the server, they're not written in C++ anyway, right? They're like kind of written in something else. And then when it comes to like rendering things or like the stuff that has to be fast, if it crashes occasionally, that's not great, but like, kind of that's not the main focus. The main focus is to make it fast, right? The main focus is to render as many frames as possible so it looks cool. And if you can't do that, you're not gonna have a product, right? So maybe that's kind of what C++ is about. I don't know. It's difficult to say, because it's obviously also used in lots of like critical infrastructure and like operating system kernels and telecommunication and whatever. I don't know. Let's not get into this whole safety discussion again. It's kind of a bit like a black hole. It keeps sucking you in, because everybody talks about this all the time. I don't know.
Well, let's change topic a bit then, because Anders, you were a speaker at C++ on C this year, and you were talking about symbols.
Yes,
which is an interesting take. I mean, what is it we need to know about symbols? Why did you feel you needed to give a talk about it?
It's like, most of my talks is just, I'm at work and I need to figure something out and like discover some corner that hasn't been talked that much about, and like this should be a talk. If I come back next year, it's probably going to be memory models, because that's what I'm working on now.
Okay.
And there's like, I like to figure out how something works and then submit a proposal for a talk about it, because then I really have to understand it properly.
Yes. So
for me, it's like the best way to learn something.
Yeah, I've done that before.
Yeah, and the symbols thing was just because we also had several really weird things going on with symbols in the place I used to work back then, and when I wrote the talk, and just figured out this is probably useful to some people. And a lot of people have said things like, oh, so that's how it works, now I understand this error message, or oh, now I think I'm linking these things wrong, or like, oh.
So you said you had some weird stuff happening with symbols. Can you say any more about that more specifically?
Yeah, so one thing was that we were shipping a library and we were using some other library that we included. And then we had some CMake stuff to make sure we hide all all our symbols.
Right.
But then we didn't compile that other library and try it ourselves. So they had already exported some symbols. And then when we linked them, they're still exported and then they leaked out. So that, I don't remember the library, but then users had a different version of the same library. And then they sometimes found our version of the symbol and sometimes found their own. So that was the easiest one to explain. The other one was just because we were linking all our sub-projects in a stupid way. So some things ended up both in the executable and the shared library that we were using. So like the global logger pointer, you had suddenly two instances of the global logger pointer, and then only one of them were initialized. And depending on like which code path you took to get there, you get like one or the other. And
I've been bitten by that one.
And then there was a CppCon talk saying like, this is how you solve it. So then we did that, and then it turned out that didn't work on Windows. it was when you take you put an inline pointer in your header file instead of having it in this CP file, then according to the standard, then you should only get one copy of that symbol. But the standard doesn't know about shared libraries. So like what happens if you have one of them in your executable and one in the standard in the shared library, then like according to tool chains on Linux, you get only one, but according to tool chains on Windows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have been bitten by that in the past in real projects.
Yeah.
It's not very easy to fix either without re-architecting a lot of things. Yeah, that's most of my talks are just I figure something out and then I went into a talk hoping that others will benefit from
that. Yeah, well, thank you for that. That's like a public service because I don't think we get enough talks about these sort of things, but we do tend to get bitten by them.
Yeah.
Both Tamer and I said we've been bitten by that one. So.
Yeah.
Right.
Keep it up. Looking forward to your memory model talk now.
Yeah.
Oh, you have a memory model talk?
Yeah, I did one at NDC Tech Town.
Oh, I missed NDC Tech Town this year. I'm so sorry. Like, it's such a cool conference. I didn't make it this year, unfortunately. But
yeah. Yeah. So on the topic of like being an ambassador for Oslo, I think NDC Tech Town is a very cool conference to have in a small place like this.
So, yes, I can confirm. I was there once and I had a great time, and I hope I can come back again. It is a pretty awesome conference.
Although technically, of course, it's not in Oslo itself.
No, but like for everyone who's not from Norway, it's in Oslo. But for us, it's like far away. It's like an entire hour on the train. It's really far from Oslo.
Yeah. I think it's closer to 2 hours, but maybe really nice. Like,
yeah, 1.5 hours. But from the airport, it's a bit longer. So
I suppose so. Yeah.
Like 1.5 hours maybe on the train. But it's right. It's a lot of Oslo people going there because Kongsberg is a very, very small town.
Yes.
Oslo is kind of small, but Kongsberg is a lot.
Yeah.
Okay, so we talked about a lot of stuff, Anders. I think it's time for our traditional closing question, which is there anything else in the world of C++ going on right now that you find particularly interesting or exciting?
I'm looking forward to the senders, receivers kind of thing. I haven't properly read up on it yet, but we mentioned earlier I was doing something else for 5 years, and that was mainly C# and language that we were developing as well. So we did a lot of Rx and observables and stuff. I think for the right use case, I think that approach is really nice.
Yeah,
so I'm looking forward to that, and also pattern matching.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't done Rust for like 6 or 7 years. I did it for a few days only, but like that was one of the things that this is really nice. Do something like this in C++, and how it's coming. So I think, those are the things I'm excited about. Otherwise, I tend to like just in time learn C++ things.
Well, that's how it should be, really.
I mentioned we're a startup, so we have done DevOps. It's super simple. We're always on the latest Ubuntu, and then get whatever tools are there, because no one has taken the time to do something more fancy. So just recently, I got using this. I'm like, now I can write one overload instead of two overloads. And I'm like, senders, receivers, and pattern matching. And otherwise, like, I'm looking for something I also find cool is the circle stuff that Conductor is doing. It's just like so impressive what it's doing alone. So whether any of that will ever land in C++, I have no idea, but I just follow it with interest because it's cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think you're one of very few people this year who haven't mentioned reflection. So thank you for that. It's interesting that you mentioned pattern matching because I'm not sure it's actually going...
Yeah, I think that's less likely to make it into 26 at this point.
I think we'll have to wait.
Not off the table yet.
It's not off the table, but I think it's becoming increasingly unlikely we're going to get it in CSS. No,
I haven't been paying attention.
26.
Yeah.
I think CentOS receivers are already in a working draft. And I mean, there's already kind of a bunch of libraries just out there that are doing things like that. We had an episode about that.
Mm-hmm. And I think my prediction is coming true that CentOS receivers can become the new coroutines in terms of all the conference talks and things about it and lots of interest, even though nobody really understands it.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, like I said this before, like I find it really hard to understand. And I think when we did the episode on the topic, we got feedback from other people who also thought like, I don't understand how this works. So I think there will be definitely a need for people like the two of you, just kind of breaking it down and explaining to everybody what this is actually about, because it seems like it's a really powerful tool, going to make things a lot easier, but it's just not like the learning curve is not particularly, how do you say?
Yeah, I think we need the second wave of talks, I think, to start to make it more accessible.
I think, like, for learning a lot of these things, like, I don't really haven't looked much at coroutines either, but all of this thing, I think it's easier if you've done something similar in like C# or JavaScript or something, where it's just like a lot easier because you have garbage collection and other things that can like makes the implementation less mysterious, kind of. And if you have like, then you kind of have the intuition that you can, might be easier to learn it than trying to learn it from scratch.
Yeah, it's, I mean, for me, it's difficult because I come from audio where you just have callbacks. You just pass pointers around, you have callbacks. This is the world I come from. So I know how to navigate that, but anything that kind of does something else kind of breaks my brain a little bit. It's just very hard to for me to understand.
Yeah, we used a lot of Rx in C# in a previous job, and like the entire domain model and the UI was like, everything was like reactive. Mm-hmm. And debugging became super hard.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this button is suddenly disabled.
Yeah.
Why? Like, no one knows. You just try to put a breakpoint, and like, it is somewhere into some Microsoft DLL. That's where the tool came from. And it's really great for some things, but it can definitely go wrong as well.
Right.
Yeah. It's probably going to be even harder in C++ because harder to make it work correctly, and it's harder to make tools and everything is.
Okay, then I think it's time to wrap up. So is there anything else you want to tell us, Sanders, where people can reach you or how they can get involved with the CPP quiz?
Yeah, so to reach me, just I'm on like all the social medias, like waiting for one of them to win. So Mastodon and Blue Sky and Twitter, and so you can just find me on any of those places. Yeah, and if you want to get involved with CPP quiz, then there's the code for the site itself is on GitHub. And we have some open issues that would be good to get some help with, especially around porting to Django 5 stuff. So if you know Python or Django, hesitate to just pick up some small issues to get started with, like making an RSS feed and some simple things, some complicated. So
I might actually have a look at that myself.
Yeah, cool.
Okay, well, thank you for joining us today, Anders, and telling us about your new book. There'll definitely be a link to in the show notes, cppquiz.org, of course, and all the other stuff you've been working on in C++. So, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much for listening in as we chat about C++. We'd love to hear what you think of the podcast. Please let us know if we're discussing the stuff that you're interested in, or if you have a suggestion for a topic, we'd love to hear about that too. You can email all your thoughts to feedback@cppcast.com. We'd also appreciate it if you can follow CPPcast at CPPcast on X or at Mastodon at cppcast.com on Mastodon and leave us a review on iTunes. You can find all of that info and the show notes on the podcast website at cppcast.com. The theme music for this episode was provided by podcastthemes.com.